We do not see things as they are, we see them as we are. Welcome to A Walk Within, a show where we visit a short story from around the world and revisit my life experiences invoked by it to explore the parallels between the two and find newer meanings. I'm Anoop, and in today's episode, we will explore a short story, a fable from The Mysterious Stranger and Other Stories by Mark Twain, and my personal memory from my workplace to understand why we see what we want to see. Before we start, I want to thank all the listeners for their continuous support of the show. Please consider sharing this with anyone who you think will enjoy. Your recommendation is greatly appreciated. As always, let's start with the story once we are back. Once upon a time, an artist who had painted a small and very beautiful picture placed it so that he could see it in the mirror. He said, "This doubles the distance and softens it, and it is twice as lovely as it was before." The animals out in the woods heard of this through the house cat, who was greatly admired by them because he was so learned and so refined and civilized and so polite and hybrid and could tell them so much which they did not know before and were not certain about afterward. They were much excited about this new piece of gossip, and they asked questions so as to get at a full understanding of it. They asked what a picture was, and the cat explained,
"It is a flat thing, wonderfully flat, marvelously flat, enchantingly flat and elegant, and oh so beautiful."
That excited them almost to a frenzy, and they said they would give the world to see it. Then the bear asked,
"What is it that makes it so beautiful?"
"It is the looks of it,"
said the cat. This filled them with admiration and uncertainty, and they were more excited than ever. Then the cow asked,
"Ma, what is a mirror?"
"It is a hole in the wall. You look in it, and there you see picture. And it is so dainty and charming and ethereal and inspiring in its unimaginable beauty that your head turns round and round, and you almost swoon with ecstasy."
The donkey had not said anything as yet. He now began to throw doubts.
"There had never been anything as beautiful as this before, and probably wasn't now, when it took a whole basketful of sesquipedalian adjectives to whoop up a thing of beauty. It's time for suspicion."
It was easy to see that these doubts were having an effect upon the animals, so the cat went off offended. The subject was dropped for a couple of days, but in the meantime, curiosity was taking a fresh start, and there was a revival of interest perceptible. Then the animals assailed the donkey for spoiling what could possibly have been a pleasure to them on a mere suspicion that the picture was not beautiful, without any evidence that such was the case. The donkey was not troubled. He was calm and said there was one way to find out who was in the right, himself or the cat. He would go and look in the hole and come back and tell what he found there. The animals felt relieved and grateful and asked him to go at once, which he did. But he did not know where he ought to stand, and so, through error, he stood between the picture and the mirror. The result was that the picture had no chance and didn't show up. He returned home and said,
"The cat lied. There was nothing in the hole but a donkey. There wasn't a sign of a flat thing visible. It was a handsome donkey and friendly, but just a donkey and nothing more."
The elephant asked,
"Did you see it good and clear? Were you close to it?"
"Oh, I saw it good and clear, O Hathi, king of beasts. I was so close that I touched noses with it."
This is very strange. The cat was always truthful before, as far as we could make out. Let another witness try. Go, Baloo. Look in the hole and come and report.
So the bear went. When he came back, he said,
Both cat and the donkey have lied. There was nothing in the hole but a bear.
Great was the surprise and puzzlement of the animals. Each was now anxious to make the test himself and get at the straight truth. The elephant sent them one at a time. First, the cow. She found nothing in the hole but a cow. The tiger found nothing in it but a tiger. The lion found nothing in it but a lion. The leopard found nothing in it but a leopard. The camel found a camel and nothing more. Then the hathi was wroth.
I would have the truth if I had to go and fetch it myself.
When he returned, he abused his whole subjectry for liars and was in an unappeasing fury with the moral and mental blindness of the cat. He said that nobody but a near-sighted fool could see that there was nothing in the hole but an elephant. Moral by the cat?
You can find in a text whatever you bring, if you will stand between it and the mirror of your imagination. You may not see your ears, but they will be there.
Now, before I continue my memory, few things. I've changed names of the individual and few circumstances for the obvious reasons of privacy. You can think of it as a dramatization of my personal experience. With that said, let's jump right in. I joined a new team, and being in consulting, was working with many different vendors from different consulting companies. It was one of the biggest programs that I ever worked on. I was setting up my new team and was looking internally for new members. During a coffee break, my boss asked me to take one individual from his team. Anyone but him, I replied. See, being part of the same larger team, I knew that person. He's been with our organization for more than 5 years. A shy, non-social individual, always working in someone's shadow, who struggled to get even one sentence out. We all have that one coworker that we feel is just lucky to be there and is not pulling their weight. He was that person that we will call Raj. I was not alone in my position of this perception. All of his teammates and some in engagement leadership group shared similar views of his lack of consulting skills and inability to contribute. I continued to protest the suggestion and asked to vet other profiles and even proposed to bring in my old team members on board. I tried to reason by saying, "It is a bad idea. We are setting ourselves up for failures from the beginning. To the extreme, just because you want him out of your team, don't dump it on me. If you want to get rid of him, do it without kneecapping me." Uncharacteristically though, my boss told me that I have no choice. And once Raj is part of my team, I'm free to take any decision that I feel is right. The break concluded, and I was devastated at the thought of starting my new team with someone like Raj. I saw a ray of hope though. Any new team member had to be interviewed and selected by client. Obviously, he will not be selected in the interview, and no one can blame me if client does not select him. As preparation for the interview, I shared the direction of the program with Raj, what is expected out of him, and where we may be headed. I can't remember hearing more than, "Okay, Anoop. No, I look forward to working on this. No, I'm excited to be part of this." Or even, "This seems like a great opportunity for career growth." Nothing. Just, "Okay, Anoop." Followed by, "I can do it." After the interview, to our surprise, Raj was given a go-ahead. I wondered how he cleared the interview. The guy struggles to talk. Maybe the client is desperate and Raj's immediate availability made them select him. Or somehow, my boss influenced his inclusion in the team. Some people are just that lucky. We began working together. he started supporting a core area of the application. I would talk to him many times during the day, ask him, how are things? Is everything under control? And offered my help in case of anything. Okay, Anoop, is all I received. After about a month, to my dread, I ran into our client leader in the hallway. He specifically said he does not like Raj and continued walking. Nothing else. No reason was given, but it did not take us much effort to fill in the details ourselves. Obviously, Raj messed up and is not up to the mark. I decided to talk to Raj. On my way to his desk, I was joined by our engagement leadership group, who also heard the feedback. "I told you so," I remarked. The entire group, including my boss, then decided to get into a room and asked Raj to join. Suffice to say, it turned into his trial. He was asked, what is the issue? Why did we fail? His response was that there is no issue, but he failed to explain why. After a while, frustratingly, he was told that we need to bring in HR into the conversation now, since he is not taking it seriously. He repeated, "There is no issue." I was tasked to meet with the client leader, who shared the feedback and fix it. Offering apologies along with a proposal to replace Raj was on the table. I entered the client leader's room and inquired about his feedback. He began by showing me an email that he received from the application owner. As a habit, I scrolled down to see the origination of the email thread to get a better context. The issue became clear. Raj had uncovered a gap in the process, fixed it in advance, and notified application owner about this potential failure point in the process and how he has fixed it. The application owner misread it as Raj notifying him of an actual failure event and escalated to client leader, who in turn said, "I don't like him." After explaining the situation, the escalation was resolved and Raj continued to be part of my team. In the following feedback session, I shared with Raj my misperception of him and I apologized. His response, "Okay, Anoop." So why did the animals only saw themselves, and why the leadership, including me, believed that it was something that Raj did or did not do to warrant an escalation? It's due to a phenomenon called motivated perception, in which our conscious motivations, our desires and fears, shape the way we interpret information. To understand a little more, let's visit a study. In a 2019 study by researchers at UC Berkeley, participants, while in the fMRI scanner, were shown composite images that included a mix of a face and an indoor or outdoor scene with different proportions. Participants were asked to categorize these images into more faces or more scene in just 4 seconds. For each correct categorization, they will receive money. The researchers then manipulated participants' motivation by telling them that if they see, for example, a face over a scene in the next image, they may win or lose extra money. The results revealed that the participants tended to categorize the confusing image as representing a face. Thus, the participants' assessment was influenced by their want to view a specific image, demonstrating both a perceptual and a response bias. They were more likely to report seeing what they had wished to see, as well as to actually see what they had wished to see. In short, they were actively looking for faces in the image rather than making their own decision whether the image was face or the scene. So how did the study arrive to this conclusion? Everything starts with the eyes. The primary visual cortex in the brain receives the information from the eyes. two streams hypothesis suggests that information is further processed in two visual streams. The ventral stream, which is thought to be responsible for encoding what we are looking at. And the dorsal stream, which identifies where within our environment the visual event occurs. In the ventral stream, there are specific areas containing neurons that are more selective for perceiving faces and neurons that are specialized in scenes. If there is more activity in one of those neurons, the participant made a perceptual judgment, a face or a scene. The study suggests is that the neurons in these regions can also be influenced by attentional and reward system of our brain. As such, greater motivational biases were linked to more neural activity in ventral stream, while the activity in the brain's reward system correlated with participants' response biases. As this research demonstrated, influences taint not only our cognition, emotion, and behavior, but also, quite literally, how we see the world. So what can we do to see things clearly? As the lead author of the study, Wan Chang Liang, said, if we are aware of how our desires color our perception, we can take steps towards mentally correcting for the bias. Also, knowing that others could truly be seeing things differently from us, and neither of us is necessarily closer to the objective reality, we would be better able to empathize with how they act and feel. More specifically, in her fantastic book, The Scout Mindset, Julia Galef suggests three thought experiments that can help us challenge our biases. First, selective skeptic test, which is by asking yourself, would you still believe the evidence even if it goes against what you want to be true? Second, the outsider test, by imagining that you are a total outsider in any given situation. And lastly, status quo bias test. We easily develop a bias for status quo, but by encouraging the bias that favors the unfamiliar, we'll be able to fight our biases for the familiar. In the end, we should always try to get an accurate picture of the reality, even when that's unpleasant or inconvenient. Let's learn to feel proud instead of ashamed when we notice we might have been wrong about something. Be open, be curious, because we see what we want to see. As James Allen said, mind is the master power that molds and makes, and man is mind, and evermore he takes. The tool of thought and shaping what he wills brings forth 1,000 joys, 1,000 ills. He thinks in secret and it comes to pass. Environment is but his looking glass. That's it for this episode. I hope you enjoyed it. And if you did, share it with others. The link to the story, along with the study mentioned in the episode, is available in the show notes. You can also find there links to the amazing book, The Scout Mindset by Julia Galef, along with William Fish's Philosophy of Perception, if you want to go deeper in the topic. Thank you for listening. Until next time, stay as awesome as you are.